Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 122, recorded Thursday, July 7th, 2016. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: data-hungry phones and dramatic Iceland. Coming to you once again, yet again, from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, on a rare week off the road. And I hate to say a rare week, but I got to tell you, looking at my calendar, it is. For the first half of the year, 26 weeks, I didn't get in an airplane during two of them. Now this week, the first week of the second half of the year, is my third non-travel week this year. Now, some of those weeks are self-inflicted, two of them to be exact, one week in Spain back in March and one in Portugal. Now, I got to tell you, that's an intense travel schedule even for me. Now, I usually find a way to take a break at least once every 6 weeks, but it hasn't worked out that way this year so far. I don't know, sometimes you control your schedule while other times it controls you. And I've definitely been on the wrong end of that leash since January. Well, since the last episode, I've been traveling pretty much exclusively between Chicago and Charlottesville, Virginia. Now, Charlottesville is a nice town, but it's a real pain to get to every week. The first direct flight from Chicago leaves around 11:30 a.m., landing at 2 p.m., not exactly convenient for the business traveler. Other earlier options are to fly into Washington Dulles and drive for 2 hours, or fly into Richmond and drive an hour and a half. What I found myself doing for the past couple of weeks is flying in Sunday night, which I absolutely hate, on the direct flight that leaves Chicago around 9:45 p.m., lands in Charlottesville around half past midnight, which of course puts me into my hotel around 1 a.m. There just doesn't seem to be an easy way around this one. At least the flights back home are convenient, 3:15 and 6:30 p.m., and it's not a crowded airport, as you might imagine. I think last week was the longest TSA line I hit. There were three people in front of me, and I think it was just longer because everybody was joking that there were only three people in front. And as I start to think about a September trip to Scotland to take our daughter back to university, I'm taking advantage of the post-Brexit exchange rate to stock my Revolut account with some suddenly much cheaper pounds. Though it'll be another week on the road, I'll at least be significantly upgrading my Scotch choice. So following up, last week's attack on Istanbul's Ataturk airport begs the same question as March's Brussels bombing. Does more airport security actually make us safer, or just move the target around? And I've said in the last episode that the long TSA lines on the land side of security caused by stricter TSA inspections weren't making the traveler any safer. Instead, they were making us less safe, more vulnerable to a Brussels or Istanbul-type attack. And while the TSA has fixed, at least for now, some of the worst lines, the issue is going to pop up again. And somebody is going to suggest, again, that they move the security perimeter back. Say, I don't know, checking itineraries and IDs at the terminal door like they do in India. The justification will be that a little bit more inconvenience is more than worth the price of safety. But if they don't staff it right, which was and will always be the core problem with the TSA, all you've done is just move the target, the line of passengers, out by another, 1,000 feet. It's less about the location and more about execution. And given the TSA's track record of execution over the past 15 years, I'm not optimistic that they'll ever get to the right answer. I got an email a few weeks ago that my 5-year global entry membership expires on my birthday this December. I don't know exactly when Customs and Border Patrol started Global Entry or rolled it out past the pilot phase, but 5 years ago, I was one of the early adopters. I mean, back then, there weren't that many interview centers. I was lucky that Chicago had one, but I had colleagues in Phoenix who had to fly up to Vegas for interviews. Now, the renewal process was pretty easy. I logged into GOES, the Global Online Enrollment System, clicked the blue Renew Membership button, and then cycled through all the profile screens. But this time, the screens were pre-populated, so I only had to make updates. And in this case, it was updating my job history for my current job and, the toughest part, entering all the countries I'd visited in the past 5 years. Now, normally, this would be pretty simple. You just sort of thumb through your passport pages and write down the country stamps. However, back in 2012, my backpack with my passport was stolen while on the train from Brussels city center to the airport, a fun time that I recount back in episode 98. Luckily, I do a decent job of cataloging travel pictures, and so flipping through the 2011 subdirectory reminded me that we'd visited Venice that year and that I'd traveled there by train from Paris after a couple of days of customer meetings. The renewal cost is $100, which, you know, if you think about that, it's 5 years, $20 a year, it's worth the price, even more so when it's free. I charged the $100 renewal on my Amex Platinum card and immediately saw the statement credit. So now I'm checking GOES every couple of days to see if Customs just sort of waves my renewal through, or I have to go and talk again to the nice people in the bowels of O'Hare's Terminal 5. I'm hoping that with the crush of new pre-check applications, they'll take the easy route for me and for them. And as we've talked before, I mean, I'm not really sure why anybody would sign up for just pre-check instead of Global Entry. I mean, Global Entry gets you pre-check, and it's just $15 more, $100 instead of $85. $15, I mean, let's face it, that's the price of a beer at O'Hare nowadays. But if you're not up for the $100 passport, the passport line cut, Arnold Heines, a longtime Travel Commons listener, pinged me on Twitter about another option, the mobile passport app from, you know, Customs and Border Patrol. I've seen it pop up in a couple of articles. Actually, just today, Alan Marco, another longtime Travel Commons listener, actually sent me a link to an article about it. Personally, I have not used the mobile passport app because, like I just said, I've got Global Entry, so I'm just hitting the kiosk and walking through. Now, my wife tried to get my son to download the app before his return flight from Reykjavik, but he never got around to it, and he said, the early evening lines at O'Hare weren't that bad anyhow. So while I don't have any first or even second-hand experience with the mobile passport app, one of the tech writers at the Wall Street Journal wrote up a glowing review probably about a week or so ago. Check out the show notes for a link to that article. And hey, if you've tried the mobile passport app, shoot me a note with your thoughts. Now, during my flight back home last Wednesday, the flight was coming in on approach into O'Hare. You could feel the gradual descent, slowly descending. And then, all of a sudden, I'm pressed against the back of my seat as the plane rotates in the wrong direction, up, that is, and the engines kind of roar with thrust. Now, the experienced travelers know that the pilot had to abort the landing. But those who have not gone through that drill, are kind of looking around going, what the hell? Now, after about 5 minutes, so the pilot came on. The plane in front of us hit a bird. Now, they have to physically inspect the runway before another plane can land, so we had to do a fly around. He said, we'll be down in 10 minutes. Now, that was a nice announcement, and actually I learned something new. I did not know they had to inspect a runway after a bird strike, though, you know, it makes a lot of sense. Now, too often, though, pilots and gate agents don't take the time to explain the cause of a delay or a fly around, or they just don't want to have to deal with the follow-up questions that may come. So I appreciate those that do tell us what the hell's going on. I remember a Southwest flight out of New Orleans. The plane lands. It was a bit late, but we're not boarding right away, which is very unusual for Southwest. You could kind of feel the impatience building in the gate area. The agent got on the PA. She said, sorry for the delay in boarding, but the plane was struck by lightning on its descent. The pilots have to do a physical inspection before we can board. Now, okay, now that makes sense. And just as you could feel the impatience build, it immediately drained away with that announcement. I don't know, maybe because the delays weren't the airline's fault. I mean, no negligence, no bad judgment on Americans' part for having to do a fly around for the bird strike, or for Southwest's, you know, getting their plane struck by lightning. You know, a bit tougher to suck up when it's a third delay in a row caused by maintenance issues, as you guys have heard me complain many times. You know, hey, guys, spend some of those record profits on some preventative maintenance. Or when the flight's delayed by a missing crew, you know, maybe you should put a little bit more slack in your scheduling. But as always, you know, more transparency is better than vagueness, and even if it's not the best story for you, the airline. And hey, if you've got any thoughts, vague or not, questions, a story, a comment, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address, as always, is comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com. You can use your smartphone to record and send in an audio comment. Send a Twitter message to M. Peacock. You can post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page, or there is always the comments section on the Travel Commons website, travelcommons.com. So the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is data-hungry phones. I met up with a friend at Empirical Brewing here in Chicago, which is one of sort of three microbreweries that are boom, 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 right, you know, one right after the other on Ravenswood Avenue up on the northwest side. I hadn't seen him since he had gotten back from a trip that he and his son did to Helsinki, St. Petersburg, and Moscow. Now, among other problems that they had, he had problems getting his son's AT&T iPhone to work in Helsinki. You know, I told him, I said, well, that's odd. I have never had a problem with those GSM iPhones from AT&T working in Europe. Well, he had called AT&T, and he said AT&T told him to reset the phone, which he did. And he said, after which, it promptly downloaded a gig and a half of apps and data over the cellular data network, roaming. So as you might guess, now he's got a, $200, $300, $400 mobile bill to dispute. It always surprises me how much data my phone uses when I travel outside of the country. I mean, I'm sure one of the reasons for this is that it's about the only time I look at my data usage since I'm grandfathered into one of the old AT&T unlimited data plans. So I really don't know how much I use domestically, normally, and I don't really make a big effort to limit it. So when I travel overseas, I get to see kind of how my kids live, their mobile lives, trying to stay under a 300 megabyte data cap. Now, international mobile data has gotten a bit cheaper. T-Mobile offers, a reasonably unlimited international data plan. I mean, if you can live with the slower 2G-style speeds, I mean, good for email and, you know, and messaging. You know, not so great if you're running an app or trying to run Google Maps. Quite honestly, I'm not that patient, so I tend to get the AT&T 300 megabit package. It's about $60 because it also then comes with free access to a decent number of Wi-Fi hotspots internationally. Now, living on a data budget means thinking which apps really need mobile data, which, I mean, if you really think about it, it's not that many. So typically what happens is while I'm sitting on the plane waiting for everybody to board, I pull up my iPhone, go over to settings, cellular, and then start turning off cellular data access for most of my apps. Now, I mean, you know, I'm not, you know, you look at it, you're like, I'm not quite sure why the healthcare flexible spending app or the app that comes with my sous vide immersion heater, why they need to access cellular data. I mean, in the U.S. or internationally. So anyhow, I kind of scroll through those, down to the last, turning most of them off, and certainly that damn Wi-Fi assist slider on the iPhone. And then after I've sent that last Snapchat saying bye, I hit the reset statistics, so I have a clean view of how much data I'm burning, and then I click over to airplane mode. And then when I land, I come out of airplane mode, go back into settings cellular, and then turn roaming on and catch up on the overnight email while, you know, waiting to get off the plane. Then at some point that morning, usually if I've, you know, gone through custom or immigration and customs, had a cup of coffee, maybe I'm in the cab, I go, you know, I look at the current period data usage, and oh my God, I see they've burned through, say, 75 meg of my 300 meg budget, like 25% of the total package in the first morning. I mean, holy crap. I immediately then dive back into settings and start turning and turn off roaming. I mean, you know, what happened? Well, this is where, at least on the iPhone, and Android is a little bit better, but it's not perfect. But at least on the iPhone, this is when you've got to start spelunking through the mess that the settings app has become. I mean, you scroll down past all the apps, you shut off from cellular access, and then you look at that last entry. It says system services. And you see right there that it's consumed at least half of that 75 meg. I mean, what? You click through. I mean, why did this phone use that much data on time and location or general? That's useful. Or iTunes accounts. I mean, hey, look, I thought I shut off iTunes in the last screen. And so this is when you got to start to dig deep, you know, settings, privacy, location service. And you find a whole nother list of apps, kind of, you know, just like this one you just used before to turn off all the cellular data. But this one is for accessing your location. And look, as much as I love the Tortas Frontera restaurants in O'Hare, I'm really not sure why their app needs to pull my location information. And then you go to Settings, General, Background App Refresh for yet another list of apps where you shut off their permission to update themselves in the background. And then you go over to Settings, Mail, and turn Fetch New Data to off to keep your iPhone from constantly pinging your Exchange server. You know, it ends up being kind of like whack-a-mole, and you'll be sure to miss something because these phones and the apps we load on them are, for the most part, built on the assumption of ubiquitous, unlimited data access. So changing that behavior, those assumptions, to severely limit the data the phone inhales and exhales, I mean, that takes a chunk of work on our part, which is why, you know, if I'm going to be somewhere for more than 4 or 5 days, I'll invest the hour that it takes to find a local phone store and invest the $25 per phone to buy a local SIM because it usually comes with a gig or two of data. Now, when I was in Iceland for 4 days in March, it didn't really seem that necessary. But when I flew down to Spain for 8 days, my first stop was the Orange store because I knew my phone absolutely couldn't hold its breath that long. So the second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is dramatic Iceland. So watching Iceland make its Cinderella run in the Euro 2016 soccer tournament, like, you know, right up until the time they face-planted into France last weekend, reminded me of the trip my son and I took in March. Some of the reaction shots that ESPN did from Reykjavik were places that we had been. You know, we saw a coffee shop we'd hit, you know, while trying to stay awake on our first day there. And then there was the square they did some shots from that was where it was a square that one of our hotels was on. I mean, it's not that surprising since downtown Reykjavik isn't that big. I mean, I guess if I'd paid more attention to the people sitting next to me in the bars off that square, I probably would have recognized some of the people in those reaction shots, too. Now, Iceland is a hot tourist destination, especially for people looking for something a bit different. And, you know, if I didn't know it already, then when Dorlinger Kindersley, you know, when those folks sent me review copies of their relaunched Eyewitness Travel Top 10 Guides, and I mentioned that a couple of episodes ago, in and amongst the usual suspects, New York, London, Paris, Barcelona, was Iceland. In 2015, there were 1.3 million foreign tourists hitting Iceland. That's almost four times the population of 329,000, and a 29% increase over the visitor count in 2014. It's a hot destination, and it's getting hotter, perhaps even to the point of overheating. And especially with WOW Air, kind of a kinder and quirkier Spirit or Ryanair, with WOW expanding the number of North American gateway cities, it's getting more folks. We ran into a lot of people who had seen ads for cheap WOW airfares and then flew over to Iceland for a 3 or 4 day weekend just on a whim. Really just like, wow, let's go. And without really thinking about what they were going to do, what they were going to see, it was just, let's go. We'd see folks walking up and down the downtown shopping and entertainment district in Reykjavik, and then, you know, see them wandering around, see them in and out of bars, and then trying to figure out, you know, kind of some day trip bus rides out to the Golden Circle hotspots. And I mean, and this was in March, not exactly the garden time in Iceland, but there are a lot of folks there. And so in that way, Iceland felt very small. On our second day, we picked up a rental SUV, a Dacia Duster. It was just a great vehicle. I loved it. And we headed out of town. Now, once we got out of Reykjavik's sort of catchment area, kind of the neighborhood, and the ring of suburbs, Iceland opened up quickly. I mean, the drama of the scenery, the spaces carved out by volcanoes and glaciers, they call it the land of fire and ice. It just made everything just feel much more spacious. Of course, I mean, you could see this same space from the seat of a tour bus for those folks going on those day trips, but I was glad we rented a car. We got off the well-worn paths, and not too far, but when driving across a plain on a two-lane highway with no traffic to speak of, the vistas, they did open up in front of us, which made me glad I was able to look forward and enjoy them through the expanse of the front windshield instead of kind of looking off to the side through a motor coach window. And when we did hit some of the typical spots, Thingvellir Park and Gullfoss Waterfall, in our own car, we could kind of ride out the ebb and flow of the tour bus traffic and have these spots pretty much to ourselves, even for just a little while. Or there was the time when we were driving toward the south coast over a plain, running kind of through a series of rain bands, in and out and in and out. I got to tell you, I was starting to get really annoyed. Until I looked out the rearview mirror and saw this huge double bow, this huge double rainbow. I immediately pulled into a gas station and got out of the car. The landscape was wide open. We could see the rainbow from end to end. I can't remember a similar experience I've had in the U.S. It was just a phenomenal sight. And I got to tell you, the smoked lamb sandwich we bought afterwards in the gas station wasn't bad either. You know, I struggle sometimes when asked about Iceland. Would I recommend it? I mean, Reykjavik is nice enough, but it's a small town. I'm not a museum guy, so there's probably, I don't know, about a day and a half of stuff for me to do there. And Iceland is expensive. I had very good fish and very good lamb, but it wasn't cheap. And hotel rooms were tight in March, so I gotta figure the country's completely sold out now and in August. But the scenery outside of Reykjavik, I keep coming back to that word dramatic. I'm not sure it does it justice. Actually, I'm pretty sure the word doesn't do it justice, but it's all I got. And so if you get a car, then that trip to Iceland starts to make sense. Well, that, the car, the dramatic scenery, and the fermented shark chased with shots of Brennevin, Icelandic schnapps, because, I don't know, how can you not do that? Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 122. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Check out the show notes for the music links. You can always find us at SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, Google Podcasts, Google Music Podcasts, Google Play, whatever they're calling it now, We're on there too. And always, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along. Text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, to M. Peacock on Twitter, on Travel Commons on Facebook. Post them on the website, travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, post comments on the website. Arnold, Allen, Dan Grinwald, just everybody. I really appreciate that that feedback. As always, I say it really helps me because it helps add content. So again, thanks for listening. And until we talk again, safe travels. And thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.